Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
So, Evan Chaplitsky. Who are you, right? I'm going to give a quick summary. You can tell me if I'm completely wrong. Evan Chaplitsky, he's the guy who created Elm.
That's true.
That really lovely, friendly, typed functional programming language, right?
Thank you.
You're also, which I think not so many people have realized, you're a really good thinker about how functional programming should impact people. Right, you are surprisingly good at thinking, hey, this isn't just a maths idea, this is a talking to people idea. Right. And as part of that, I think when the big book of computing history gets written, I hope there's a chapter that says, did you notice around the 2010s, programming languages started to get much better error messages? Like new ones worried about it, and old ones started to improve them. That's all down to you.
Well,
I think you were the spearhead of that.
I really appreciate you saying that. That's definitely been one of the things I've been most proud of in my work. And it's been cool to talk to other language compiler authors and hear them, what they're working on with their error messages and sharing techniques and stuff.
Yeah. So this is a big topic we need to get into, like beyond the language, talking to other people. But I know the internet will explode with comments if I don't start with this question, right? You've just done a talk about success stories of Elm. Elm hasn't had a release in like 5 years.
That's true.
What's the state of Elm?
Yeah, so essentially what happened was Elm, I was developing it as an open source engineer employed by a company using Elm a lot. And eventually I realized that as Elm was growing, my ability to handle that growth wasn't keeping up, right? So like if I made a contribution that a lot of people liked and was really valuable, that would bring in a new wave of people. But how I was assessed in my professional relationship, that had no relation on whether there would be a colleague who could help me with that new amount of workload that's coming in. And so essentially around 2019, 2020, I realized that like, I'm permanently hitting this wall where like my assessment is my value to this organization. And that isn't proportional to the amount of work and difficulties I'm going to run into as the language itself is more successful.
Yeah.
So I made the explicit decision of like, I can't invest more in growing the language until investing in that growth also is correlated with an ability to support that growth. Does that make sense?
It does make perfect sense. And it seems like the classic trap of open source.
For sure.
Doesn't sound like you found the great secret to getting venture capitalists to fund your programming language. But did you look into like, okay, so let's make it a community thing or let's start the Elm Foundation? I know
you
could do that.
I did make a foundation. There are a lot of different things you can try. And I went and looked at them and talked to different language creators to see like how they feel about it. And so for me personally, going on a donation model, I felt, for me personally, psychologically, I wouldn't be able to deal with that. Because the real issue that I was having when I had these corporate sponsors was that my value to them wasn't the value of my technical work, it was how they perceive me. And in a donation structure, like I can do technical work that's like definitely valuable to a lot of businesses, but if it's not perceived in the right way, if it doesn't flow through Hacker News and Twitter in the right way, like that affects my ability to run a stable organization where people are like happy and secure and feel like they have a career. So essentially I kind of always thought of Elm with like a farmer mindset, which is to say like in some years you have good years, you have good crop. And what you do when that happens is you don't go buy a nice car, is you save that away because one year it's going to be rainy, one year it's not going to be sunny. So effectively, I saved up such that if there are bad times, I'll be able to work through them on my own terms so that I'm not putting myself in the language in a situation that I don't feel is sustainable long term.
Mm. But that, like, working through on your own terms, from what I know of you as, like, the guy who makes great error messages, who wants to talk to people, who just gave a talk about, like, why functional programming matters to non-programmers, I would have expected to work on your own terms to be much more public, right? I would think working on your own terms means communicating to lots of people.
Normally.
Okay. And so we did have the pandemic, so maybe that's a factor.
Yeah. Essentially, what I ran into in 2020 was I had been working on Elm for 10 years, and there were all these companies using it successfully. And when I went to them and I said, what are you struggling with? Where should I focus my energy? The answer was always like, well, it's going pretty good. We're actually struggling a lot with our back end. Like, again and again, I got that response.
Yeah.
And at some point, I kind of, you know, it's not so motivating to say this project's going to take a year and, like, everybody doesn't care. And so, like, and also I've been working on it for 10 years. Like, I was ready to try something outside of, you know, optimizing my compiler to be better and better, but, like, can I gain more skills? Like, can I have technical career growth as well? Right. And so that's when I started focusing on, like, what would these kinds of things look like on the back end? But in doing that, if you say, hey, I'm going to do that publicly, you then create this whole world of expectations of, like, it should look like this. I think it's going to be like that. And so I kind of thought of it as, like, it's like if a company was going to release a new car, and then so they announced 5 years in advance all the features of the car and how fast it was going to be and how cool it was going to be. And then ultimately it wouldn't be exactly like that. And the excitement that happened then is wasted in that, like, that excitement could have been people going directly to try it out.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen. So I think just on a practical level, because working on a language or backend language is such a long-term investment, and because you kind of, you don't want to promise something that you can't make. Like, I was in a sort of difficult situation to work on that kind of work and meet the needs or the demands of everybody else going on and what they are looking for in the world. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It makes you wonder two things. Like, you sort of disappeared, I felt, which is entirely your right to do, but did you ever feel like you should have handed it off, like passed the baton on Elm while you did this other thing?
I mean, I kind of looked at it as I have personal relationships with the companies that use Elm that I know about, and if they have anything that they're looking for, we will talk about it. So, like, the idea that what a language is like what it's perceived to be online, I think is a little bit of a silly understanding of it. And it's like having those direct relationships with people who are, like, legitimately invested in it, like, I think works as well. And so that was kind of the attitude I took.
Okay, that's fair enough.
So through the past few years, like, I've kept in contact with these different companies and show them updates on what's going on. And so I want them to know, like, what's happening, even though it's not certain, like, okay, this back-end thing's going to be exactly this or whatever.
Yeah, okay. So that takes me to the other thread I was thinking of going to. The fact that you're talking about it openly now suggests you are closer to the end of that development period than the start.
Yeah, for sure.
What's on your mind right now? What are you working on? To the degree that you're comfortable announcing it on record.
Basically, the core things I'm working on, I feel confident that what I wanted to do, I can achieve. And it's more now saying, like, okay, how do I get into a state where I can present it to people well?
Okay.
So we're kind of at the start. Like, I've been doing little private talks where I'll do a demo and talk to people and say, hey, are you interested in this? And try to start to work with people privately to prove that it works and get the kinks worked out. Because again, like, releasing something like this, if I go back in time to when I was 22, like doing all this work in the open is different because nobody knows who I am and it's all just, you know, some weird guy posting online.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in this case, like I didn't want to, I don't want the level of scrutiny that will come to me until I'm ready. I feel confident that I can sustain that.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah. An example of that is like, I think when Dart came out, I think they really got slammed because it was connected to Google, right? Like if it had just been Dart, the language, by the guy who worked on a JavaScript VM, and it had somehow been organizationally separate from Google, I think its reception would have been really different. And so these are kinds of factors that I look at what's happened and I say, I don't want to get slammed like that.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair. Saying it comes from Google is a really double-edged sword. Right?
And they got, from a compiler author's perspective, like people were saying really silly critiques. So like they were like, oh, the code size is really large in the initial release. And it's like, yeah, you don't, like when you're first making a language, you say, well, there are problems that are hard that I need to know if I can solve. And there are problems that are known and easy and anyone can do anytime. Mm. And like you end up getting criticized on these silly ones that from a person knowledgeable in the field would be like, you can't assess it on that.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah,
that's,
I mean,
life.
I think we've all faced that at work. Even those of us who aren't compiler authors, we have shown a feature in its prototypical state to a manager, and they don't get the idea of a prototypical state, right?
And it just it's very particular to the particular technology. Like, yeah, what?
There is a time to show people stuff. So,
yeah, exactly.
Okay, I'm going to back away from that
Thank
topic
you.
A little
Thank
bit
you.
Respectfully.
I appreciate that.
But I'm still going to approach it from another angle,
okay.
Right? So if I want to know where Haskell thinks programming is going, I go and read academic papers.
Sure.
If I want to know where Unison is going, well, I can pretty much guess that it's as much collaboration as it is functional programming, right? So my question is, without detailing your personal plans, where would you like programming to get to in the next 5-10 years? What do you think we're still missing?
I mean, I have a, you know, somewhat provincial answer. It's not like a big idea thing, but it's just like for the companies that I think have seen success with functional programming, having that type safety flow through the whole stack, through their whole system, where it's like, if I can make a change in my database and see the nice, helpful error message in my front end and in my server, is like, I think that could be really huge, and that's something that a lot of the companies that I like talk to really want. And it feels like there's efforts all over to try to obtain that through, like, we write these contracts, we use these data interchange formats. And so for me, having compilers that can actually analyze the full system is something I'm excited about.
Okay, yeah, yeah, I can see that. This reminded me of your talk in which you had a number of case studies. It was like they had Elm on the front end, it was great. They had something else on the back end, maybe that wasn't so great, and the interface between the two of them was broken.
That's where they would see errors, for sure.
So you are thinking of taking your success in the front end and capturing more land?
Well, I don't personally see it that way. For me, it's more of like I have a career as a compiler author, and like I want to have career growth and do interesting work, and this is interesting work that I think can be valuable to people.
Okay. Are you rethinking value at all?
What do you mean?
I mean, as a compiler author, it's very easy to be poor and unheard of.
Yeah, right? I'd agree with that.
And are you thinking, I mean, there's a certain amount of reputational success you have thanks to Elm. What do you think the success of your next step as a compiler author, assuming it happens, what would it look like? Will money be a factor? Will the ability to carry on being a compiler author be a factor? Will number of people who use it and love it?
Yeah, I think for now the best I can say is I did a talk at The Last Strange Loop called The Economics of Programming Languages that kind of lays out the challenges you face in an environment where like there are big players who can essentially whatever thing valuable thing you're doing in open source, they can come and capture it and have all that money flow to them. So like how I look to like database projects where they often have models where they're able to protect themselves from Amazon and still be able to support the database that they're working on. So like maybe an example of this is like Nginx. I don't know if people know this, but like Nginx is open source, but there's also an Nginx Pro. And they've done a really clever thing of like, basically, there are certain things that only companies, only large companies want, and no one else would even think about them or know that they exist. And so those are the things that is in the Pro version. And so there's ways to draw lines like that. And to be clear, Elm is open source. It'll always be open source. I'm not talking about Elm.
We're not talking about Elm Pro.
Yeah, no, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And I don't want anyone to think that. That's not going to happen. Elm is BSD3. It'll always be.
Front page of Hacker News tomorrow. Elm Pro is coming.
Don't do this to me.
No, sorry. So what are you saying?
I did a talk a year ago that I think lays out the challenges in a way that I'm comfortable talking about.
Okay. Oh, okay, I'm not here to make you uncomfortable. I'm here to pick your brains on interesting things.
Yeah.
So let me back away from that topic respectfully and talk about...
There's another way that I can say it, which is like, I think when you go and publish code for other people to use, you're really putting yourself out on a limb to say like, I trust that the people benefiting from this will take care of me. And what I kind of got the message with Elm was that that's not true. Mm-hmm. You know, like when you have a venture-backed Silicon Valley company, like they're in their list of priorities, like taking care of you and doing the right thing is not like that high.
Yeah. The audience are horrified by this thought. They never considered it that much.
Yeah, so that's like part of, you know, like for me as a programmer who's excited to share ideas, like I want to just share the idea, but at the same time, like I also need to protect myself from, you know, people who say they self-identify, I'm a capitalist, I'm a venture capitalist, who want, if there's free value, they'll take it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like a more complicated thing than just this old discussion of like, well, Eric Raymond in 1990 said da 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 da, and so like that's the only framing we can use to analyze these projects.
Yes, okay. It's reminding me of, like, I used to do a lot of open source stuff, and one thing you realize doing open source is like people will assume you're promising to maintain things forever for free and provide features for free forever. And that was kind of fun before I had kids. And when I had kids, the price of one spare hour went to infinity.
Yeah.
And suddenly I realized the economic agreement
there. Yeah, and I mean, I saw that with, as people in Elm World got older and had kids, is like you start having this decision in your head. It's like, I can handle this incoming request or whatever, or I can spend time with my son.
Or you know what I mean? And it's 60 minutes of sleep.
And it's like, on what basis can I say that talking to the stranger is more important than... And it's just like, you can't do that. And so it's... That's another reason why I felt like having some kind of organizational solution was important. So that like, I mean, at some point I talked to a CTO of a company that are using Elm. And we were talking about like ways we can do some kind of cultural... investment, like get things going, get blog posts going. And I was like, kind of had a limit of like, I don't personally ask people to do open source work. And I say specifically, if you're having fun, I encourage it. But once you stop, it's like, this isn't like people will take things from you legitimately. And like, you have to be able to protect yourself. So just because of the experiences I've had, I don't want to then turn around and walk someone else down that same path that I went down. And the CTO was like, oh, but I think they would do it for free. Right. And it's like, and that was exactly the issue that I had through my career of like, I literally just heard exactly what you said about how this messes up people's lives. But it's like, yeah, but like, who cares?
Yeah. Yeah.
We definitely see that in the industry, and I don't I don't see a solution, so I'm not going to spend too much time asking you if you have an absolute solution to it.
Okay, actually, I would like to share some thoughts there. Mm. So I think part of what had been so powerful about open source is that it captured this kind of like anti-corporate sentiment. But when you go to the founding documents, it really is from a specifically libertarian perspective. And like Eric Raymond has said in interviews, like, maybe this is a way to smuggle my values into these corporate structures and have them run in a specific way. And so I think it's ultimately a politically specific analysis of our industry. And for me personally, I look at it a little different in the sense that, like, I think a family business and a publicly traded business and are categorically different entities, right? Like, and so once you start doing a more thorough analysis, like, the energy that is against like large companies taking advantage of small people, it's like you can have a more interesting conversation than just like, is the code free or is the code not free? It's like, are we able to support small creators or not, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, one classic issue when you have a system that doesn't have any kind of like power distribution analysis is that it ends up being very favorable to powerful institutions, right? So like, if you have a open source project with one developer and then you have a organization that can say, here are six people who can replicate that or just take the code wholesale and add on to it, and we have a marketing team and and it's like, is that in the original spirit of like being anti-corporate that is like explicitly permitted in the way that we generally think about things based on this old writings from 1990 or whatever?
Yeah, so maybe you're saying we need we need to kind of update the open source mindset.
How I think of it is, like, I think we're seeing a lot of creators like get burnt out and run into these walls. And I think ultimately, like, it's a failure of the analysis of the industry that if the goal is to have like independent creative programming work, like, this isn't sufficient to sustain that and make it healthy for those people. And so, like, I think, you know, there's this really interesting video of Eric Raymond where he's telling the story of, like, I was at Microsoft for some reason and some, you know, stuck-up looking VP got on the elevator with me and he says, "Who are you?" And he's like, I thought he had some pretension around him. And he says, "I'm your worst nightmare." And I mean, just watching it, I'm just like, that's, you know, life isn't Star Wars. Like, this isn't how it works. And then, you know, now 30 years later, like, it's not their worst nightmare. No. Like, they bought GitHub. They, you know,
yeah.
And when you go to the original writings, like, he's saying, look, this isn't about code should be open source because that's like the right thing. He's saying it should be open source because that's better for business. Like, I forget which essay he writes that, but he has like, here are the six scenarios where it's just better for business. And like, on top of that, all these cultural elements are put, but ultimately, like, we are now multiple decades later, and like, it wasn't the worst nightmare of Microsoft. Like, all the big companies that are able to like take advantage of things have embraced it. And so, yeah, like, if our initial thing is like to be anti-corporate, it's like we have to look at ourselves and be like, on what level is this way of seeing the world like serving us?
Yeah, yeah, we definitely hit the point. We definitely made the case for all the different ways that open source is better for business, and maybe we forgot to make the case for why it's better for us.
Well, yeah, but yeah, for independent people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we've talked more about business than I expected to. But I did expect to talk quite a lot about getting beyond the code, right? So the other thing I really want to talk to you about is we have this thing of value. We have this thing of great value called functional programming, typed functional programming, if you want to get into that distinction. Right? And we are definitely struggling to disseminate the value of that idea out to the world.
Mm.
And I know you're really good at thinking and empathizing with the other side of the wall. So give me some ideas on how I can do a better job of sharing the thing I think is absolute gold dust with the industry.
Well, I'll say I think, like, I'm always very positive towards languages. Whenever I look at a language, I try to see what's great about it, and I try to evaluate it based on what the language author wanted to do. So there'll be languages where everyone's like, ah, that languages suck. So let's take PHP for an example. Like, it's hard to find a real enthusiast. At least I don't run into them often.
Mm.
But when you say, what from a language design perspective is so special that made this such an influential and useful thing? And it was the directness of, like, I want a website, I have a website.
Mm.
And I think when, particularly in type functional world, people can get distracted by, like, the particular language design details and overlook, like in Ruby on Rails, I think a big moment for it was, like, setting up a website in 15 minutes. There's, like, some video where it's just like, I don't have a website, I have a website.
Yeah.
And so I think that immediacy is something that, for cultural reasons, we overlook in the typed functional world, and, like, working more there, I think, would have big effects. So, like, I use Haskell all the time, and I love it, and I think it's great. That said, I do write some of my own, like, core libraries for the kind of work that I want to do.
Mm.
And there's stuff that, you know, I want to use the standard OpenSSL library. So I write C bindings to it, and I do that for myself. But, like, if we're trying to have that immediacy, like, you can't say, well, first you choose the SSL C library that you prefer, and
yeah,
you learn.
So are you talking, I thought you were going to be talking about the immediacy of understanding these ideas.
No.
It sounds more like you're talking about, we need to improve the developer experience.
Yeah, the immediacy of taking, like, for most programmers, it's like, I'm not coming here to, like, be on a learning adventure. It's like, I'm coming here to, like, I'm excited to make an app or to make a website or to make a server. And, like, if you can do that in 5 minutes, like, all this other learning becomes, like, an exciting side quest. But, like, if you're 3 weeks in and you still haven't made the website, it's like, just, am I ever going to get there? Like, it can be really discouraging, I think. I mean, that was something. From the beginning of Elm, I had an online editor, and it was like, I'm not going to post about this until I have that editor working, so that someone can go from the idea to directly, like, oh, I made it. Oh, I changed it. Like, I can actually feel what this feels like.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think for some of the more advanced ones, like, getting to that point that, like, you and I have experienced where it feels great takes too long, basically.
Yeah, yeah. There are some languages that say, oh, you want to use this language. Okay, go download our package, and it's not going to install because you don't have this libc dependency.
Yeah, exactly,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay. Yeah, I think that's huge. And it's not, like, that glamorous. I mean, I think that you see that at Jane Street. It's like they ended up making their own core library and own, like, separate from the standard one. And it's like, it is a big investment, and I understand, like, if the core developers are academics or, you know, having some kind of industry relationship or consulting or to support themselves, then it's hard to do that. But also, I feel like that's the path. I don't know.
Okay, yeah. In that case, let me ask you a more specific design question, because you're also a very good language designer. I'm going to frame it as the Ruby on Rails. I'm going to frame it on the Ruby on Rails problem, right? The amazing thing about Ruby on Rails is you type a few lines of code and you've got a website. The thing I always hated is you type a few lines of code and you've got a maintenance problem.
Sure.
Right? And you have to make, whenever you're trying to design for accessibility and simplicity, you have to make some really good decisions, or all you do is dumb it down and lock people in. And I think Elm has made some good and hard decisions about what to worry about and what not to worry about. So I want your design thoughts on how we can, like, which parts of how do we do a developer experience that gets easier without getting toy town?
Yeah, so I think Python is a great example of this, because the Python that everyone thinks of is like a small subset of all the things you can do in Python and how inheritance works and all these kinds of things. But when you come, you say, oh, it looks really nice and light, and there's a for loop, and there's an if, and that's kind of it, you know? Oh, there's an array, okay. And so I think just because of the historical development of that language, the initial resources that everyone goes to are talking about like an early Python that was quite minimal features. And then as someone gets deeper into their path with it, they'll find out about this other stuff. But by and large, people stay in that simple area. Mm. And so I think having something like that in a language like Haskell, where it's like, look, you don't know about monads or applicatives.
Generalized algebraic data types.
It's like, we're going to put that aside as like an expert area and say, if you're just here to make a website, you're just here to make a server, use these libraries. Don't think about any of these extensions. Like, these are for specific scenarios, you know, which isn't to say to be judgmental of them. I mean, I use weird ones, but like if I was saying, hey, I'm now employed to build a organization of Haskell programmers, I'm going to specifically say, like, here are the boundaries of what we do in a like business environment, and we can get these benefits, but like for the purposes of when people come and go, we need to onboard people. Like, we can't have that level of complexity here. And you see that in like a C world where like there every feature you want is there, but every company has their own style guide of like, this is what we use and this is what we don't. Mm. And so having like a basic default of like, if you're here for the immediacy of get it up, don't have a maintenance burden, be here and don't listen to other people. And as you build that expertise, maybe venture out.
So you're saying have a small subset that's definitely immediately accessible with that, but you can keep that wider.
Yeah, you absolutely do. I mean, within my own code, so like me and my wife are both programmers. And so when she writes Haskell code for the work we do, she does so in a server system that I wrote where the routes are done a nice way. And it has this immediacy. Like, she learned Haskell before, but she's like feels really happy and productive in that setting.
This is an aspect of marriage I've not experienced.
Yeah, it's also like if you say to your wife, like, hey, I want to make this like multi-year investment in something that may or may not work out. I'm lucky that my wife is like, that's going to be cool. Let's do that.
That's pretty nice. That sounds like more support than you ever got from the venture capital. Okay, so I want to come at that from another angle as well, because there is definitely a sense that more immediately accessible languages get success in disseminating ideas. But I also, it makes me think of another language which doesn't have immediately accessible ideas and yet is being very successful, and it's Rust. Right. What's your take on Rust, but what's your take on why Rust is succeeding in mindshare?
So going back to my personal analysis of open source, when you go look at the history of what happened there, is Netscape was this like huge internet company, big success story, Wall Street's paying attention, they have this IPO, it's super high, and it falls off. And part of what happens is they have this web browser that has all these bugs. And it's totally bug-ridden. Internet Explorer is coming for them. And so they say, hey, there are these like nerds online who are talking about open source and free software. And the main thing they're talking about is like, open source is better because all bugs are easy if you have enough eyes on them. Mm. And so when you go to those old documents, you find people explicitly saying, we're going to open source Netscape as Firefox specifically to get that free labor, you know. And there's some documentary where they actually bring in someone who's like been working for free in some Midwest state. And so it's like explicitly a cynical, how do we use these people for their expertise to solve this business problem that we have?
Yeah.
And it turned out it didn't really work for them. But the organization that came from it, I'm just going to keep going, is Mozilla. And so they kind of became the arbiters of like what open source should look like, what it should be, while at the same time, like, they're getting paid by Google to so Google can be default search. So they're saying, like, open source should work this certain way, but for us, these guys pay the bills because they're kind of, like, paying us off to be default. Like, it could be anybody.
Right.
But for you, we don't talk about that. For you, here's how it's going to work. Yeah. And so I think they're, like, again, going to the Dart story, like, a big part of why that release was really traumatic and difficult was because the CTO of Mozilla came out and, like, slammed it. Like, multi paragraph of why it was a horrible thing. Mm-hmm. And so I think they have a lot of weight in culturally in terms of open source stuff, and they're very trusted. And the fact that it came out of there and that it follows all of the guidelines that they define as what open source should be, like, it, on all these levels, it culturally aligns with what it should look like. And, like, no one has to worry about where the money comes from because no one ever talks about it and no one has to think about it. You know what I mean?
It's you're an American, but you've moved to live in Denmark. Were you thrown out for not being capitalist enough?
My wife is Danish. I'll say that.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
But there's self-selection.
Okay. So let me ask a couple more questions before we turn it over to the crowd. Here's another thing I think about you, right? I have too many thoughts about you. It's not healthy. Right. We can delete that from the recording. It's like, so you are very much as a designer, and you're a good designer. Like, there are some people who are good at building compilers. There are some people who are good at design. It's rare you see both. As a designer, it seems to me part of your technique as a designer for good systems is to disappear and think and then come back when you've got a good answer.
Hmm.
Which I know Rich Hickey would endorse. Go and sit in the hammock, right? But given that you're someone who hides away until you've got a really good solution, why are you so good at, like, human affordances in your designs? Shouldn't you be out there talking to people and, like, doing systems?
There is a life accident that happened, which is what I should have done is gone and get a PhD and try to be a professor, because I love teaching and I love sharing my excitement about technical things or things I'm excited about. And by circumstances, that's not what happened to me. So I think it's just like, I really love sharing ideas and talking about them. And that's just a baseline true thing. So whenever I'm feeling sad about things, it's like, oh, like, being able to talk about interesting ideas really always livens up my... But yeah, I don't know if that answers the question.
It makes me wonder if, in order to get more releases out of you, we should make you more sad. Because when you're happy, you disappear, right?
I mean, I think a lot of effort's been put into that, and I'd say it didn't work.
Okay, yeah. On that wonderfully cheery note, I think we'll turn it over to the audience for questions. Has anyone got any questions for Evan?
Yeah, your point about the error handling in Elm, and particularly you talked about your desire to see that flow throughout the whole stack, immediately resonated with me and made me remember an experience I had. I know where I was and what year. In 97, I was working on a Java RMI system, and I got an error, which was we have a client and a server, and the client failed, but sent me the exception of the client and the server that had been marshaled through. And I almost fell off my chair because the previous, it was you'd get no response, and then you'd go to the logs and you'd see the server had crashed and you'd stoke up a debugger. And so it was such a big jump, and I feel that perhaps we've gone back to telemetry and having to sift through logs again. So so thank you for kind of presenting the importance of error handling in terms of human productivity, but also kind of like stress levels and everything like that. But I would just wanted to ask if there was any influences to you that made you consider errors more important than perhaps other people. What were your influences?
Yeah, so because I learned Standard ML and OCaml at school and then learned Haskell kind of as a hobby, I faced these like learning challenges where I ultimately felt really betrayed, where like it had the sound of it being complicated. And so even when I felt I was like, I can do this, I wasn't confident that I understood it. And so it took like a year before I was like, oh, that's what it was the whole time. And then like 3 years later, it's like, okay, Monad Transformers, that's what it was the whole time. And so I legitimately was like, on a personal level, I felt really betrayed about my time being, or my confidence being suppressed. The other thing is that when I was working at Norad Inc., one thing we thought about a lot is we always kind of had to apologize. We're like, okay, the error messages are a little, you get used to them, you know? And I think anybody who learned OCaml or Haskell at university knows, like, after some number of months, you look at it and you kind of get it, you know? It doesn't make sense to you, but it's like, I know what to do now.
Yeah, yeah.
And we really were annoyed that we had to be like, it'll be fine. So weirdly, what happened is I was at a conference in Beijing, weirdly, and I was just like, I have some free time. I'm going to work on getting my error message to go to JSON. And as I was doing that, I was like, you know, I could actually, this could be a lot better. And I started just like tinkering with the particular engineering details of it. And it all came from that like side route. And so that's another reason like I'm not so giving roadmaps, is that like the roadmap would have said, I'm delivering this JSON feature. But what I realized as I was going through the code, it's like, oh, we can actually give really excellent error messages. And like, I don't want to close those possibilities off by making promises of like, which is more important ultimately, you know, like, so I hope that answers.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions?
If you had to start over, what would you do different?
So I think it was hard for me to come to understand this, but like I think I was naive about thinking people would take care of me. And so like I knew the creator of Python, and I kind of saw his path of like he's sort of naively making a language. Some companies support him before the 2000 tech bubble. And like, yada, yada, he works at Google, he works at Dropbox. And like, I kind of yada, yada'd the, what would happen to me. And like, to think like, oh, what happened to the Python guy, that's going to happen to me too, is like, stupid. Like, why would I didn't think like, oh yeah, that's me. But like, I didn't question that path was of a specific moment, of a specific technology, all that. And so I think when I had situations that were working, I was too trusting, and I wasn't like doing what I needed to do to be in a good situation long term. Does that make sense?
One final question. Yes. Mm.
So just linking to that question, then what's the number one recommendation you would give to some fellow developer who's getting into open source software and would love to keep going that way?
Just that,
besides
like,
don't.
Yeah, just that a lot of companies who use open source use it as a business tactic, right? So like they have a freemium thing, but that's a pipeline into a paid service. And so, and that's when you go back to the original documents about it, like that's what it's supposed to be, according to Eric Raymond. And so if you're really making sacrifices in your life and there's no path for that to come back to you, like that's serious. Like you have to solve that, otherwise you're not going to get to things you love to do. And so like from my own experience, like I was never the person who should have been in charge of a consulting organization. Like I can be talent, but like I should have pursued finding a partner who can do that other side where we both bring something valuable. And also, I also should have had the confidence of like, you know, I'm like, well, what do I bring? Like, I'm just some guy who works on compilers. I'm not even that good at Elm. I don't use it. I mostly write Haskell, you know? But like, when you bring a reputation or people who believe in you and you bring the expertise, that's like so valuable to a consulting firm that, you know, you can't let yourself be taken advantage of. And a lot of business people like will do it if you are naive about how they operate.
Yep. On that note, I think we're at time. So, Evan Chablitsky, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.